We're holding on page Samach Zion in Nidorim at the top, middle of Os Lamed Zion. The Mishnah had talked about cases where a person makes a neder not to eat cooked foods, and the Gemara had discussed what exactly is included in that category, and that led us into the whole discussion about different kinds of eating, and then inyan about different stories with the Chachamim. Page Samach Zayin at the top of Nedarim. So now the one thing the Mishnah mentions is also that among the things that a person would that among the things that are in that category of cooked things is something called Beitza Turmita, which the Gemara defines as a type of egg prepared in a certain special way, which the Gemara explains it's very difficult to prepare properly, and somebody who prepares it is a very valuable person. So that leads the Gemara into another. So that leads the Gemara into another example of foods that are very difficult to prepare and that people would pay a lot of money to learn how to prepare them. The Gemara says, "Ahu gavra diyohev avdil chavre." There was a person who gave a slave to somebody else. Lagmuri alpha mini lafti. This slave was supposed to teach the other person 1,000 different ways of preparing lafti. Lafti is a concoction. The Gemara explains it's made from figs. We find them, and so it was some kind of porridge or concoction or something like that, made out of crushed figs. We find elsewhere that it was a good food for sick people. So here, this person wanted to learn 1,000 different ways of making it, and the slave was supposed to teach that to him. Agmere tamni meya. In the end, he only ate him. In the end, he only taught him 800. So the person who had hired the slave for this purpose, or who had paid the other person to lend him a slave for a while for this purpose, took the other person to a din Torah in front of Rebbe. You promised 1,000, you only gave me 800. Omer Rebbe, so Rebbe was very taken aback by this 1,000 different ways of preparing one dish. So Omer Rebbe, Aviseinu Omru Nashinu Tova. Our ancestors said in Eicha, we have forgotten goodness. Meaning, in other words, like at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon, they had seen goodness, they had seen wealth and opulence like that, and now in the time of the Churban, we've forgotten it. But Rebbe says, Onu, afilu be'einenu lo ro, lo ra'inu. We have never even seen such a thing with our own eyes that people should be living like that so extravagantly. I never heard of such a thing. So on the face of it, the story is just that. Although there is a very interesting explanation, there's an explanation from the first Savrana Rebbe, the Moshe Tzvi. He was a Talmud of the Rebbe Yitzchok Lidichever, another Rebbeim of that time. He himself became a prominent Rebbe of his time. Anyway, he gives a fascinating explanation about this. The deeper meaning behind this 1,000 kinds of laughter, he says, is that there a the word laughter is related to a word to that means to connect together, like naftuli alekim niftalti. So it means 1,000 different yichudim. This person wanted the other one to teach him 1,000 different yichudim, 1,000 different kavanos in davening and how to connect with the Eivishter. In the end, he only taught him 800 of them. Why? Because Rav Moshe Tzvi explains, based on a drosha from a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, that there are 1,000 of them, but 200 of them are available only to somebody who was never poygamas brisa, somebody who always maintained the kedusha of his bris, as far as zeres or zera levatola, as far as bias asuris, etc. So now he takes the other guy in front of Rebbe. Rebbe was Rabbeinu HaKadosh. We know he never even put his hand below his waist, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos, so he's the ultimate example of kedusha, so let Rebbe teach him the other 200. But what happened was, he goes on to explain, now David HaMelech, Rebbe's ancestor, had only been able to achieve 800 of them himself. In a similar vein, the Gemara tells us in Moed Katan that even though the Pasuk says that a Jew should be able to, when we're listening to what Hashem wants, one Jew should be able to kill 1,000 of the enemy, Eicha Yirdef Echad Elef, David was able to accomplish only 800, and when he was bothered by that, and he wonders why, it was a bas called Rak B'dvar Uriah Hakiti, because he messed up in the whole matter of Uriah and Bathsheba. So in other words, David himself was only able to achieve 800. So now Rebbe could have said, sure, I can teach you the other 200, but Rebbe didn't want to make himself seem greater than David HaMelech. So therefore he says, our ancestors, referring to David HaMelech, have forgotten it, meaning they could have had it, but David didn't quite do the right thing with Bathsheba. We have never even seen it, even though, of course, he did, because he would have been zeichah to 1,000 of them. Okay. That's exactly the pasuk that Ramosha Tzvi brings in this connection. Where he understands that notrim aspiria means those who preserve the kedusha of their bris intact. Okay. Well, speaking of the wealth and the opulence in Rebbe that still existed in Rebbe's times, Rebbe himself, we know from various Gemaras, was very rich. So now the Gemara tells something about that. Rebbe Ovad Lehilula Reb Shimon Brei. Rebbe made a chasana for his son Reb Shimon v'loy azmine l'bar kapara, but he did not invite his Talmud bar kapara. Now, why not? The Ran says because the bar kapara was a very jovial kind of guy. He was a badchan, as we're going to go on to say in the story. And Rebbe was concerned that he's going to disrupt the wedding. Basically, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, Rebbe himself was always very serious. And therefore he didn't want bar kapara around by the wedding. The Medrash in Kehelas Rabba tells the story with some variations, and there it says that Rebbe just forgot to invite bar kapara. Whatever the case, bar kapara wasn't invited. Kosovar Beis Gnona. So he, who was the he, on the face of it, it's bar kapara, wrote on the wall of the chasana hall, Chaf Dalad Alfin Riboyan Dinrin Naftiar Beis Gnona Dain. 24,000 times 10,000 dinarim, so you're talking 240 million dinarim, were spent on this wedding hall, v'lay azmane le bar kapara, and bar kapara wasn't invited. So, now the words v'lay azmane le bar kapara are not in the printed Gemara, and in that case, the Gemara is not saying that point. In that case, you could understand that it's Rebbe himself wrote that on the wall. But the gius that we have here in Ein Yaakov is that Bar Kapara himself is writing. Is that Bar Kapara is writing it? So according to the first of all, what does that mean? The Ran explains that this huge amount of money we're talking about is for the wedding expenses. Marsha says it seems a little hard to say that it means for the whole Suda. You're spending such an enormous amount of money. It rather means for the hall itself. They had a minig in those times. They would have the wedding in a building, in a hall of some kind, and then after that they would gift that to the Chosin and Kala, and that would be their house. So he's saying that they spent that amount of money. And didn't invite Bar Kapara. So on the surface of it, at least we're talking about that it's Bar Kapara writing that on the wall, saying that look at this, Rebbe's not doing right. Another way of understanding it would actually be that Rebbe himself is writing that, so everybody should know how much he's putting into this wedding. But yet he didn't invite Bar Kapara, and then the next words of the Gemara are Bar Kapara's comment on the subject. Omer Lohoin or Lay. So Bar Kapara says, if this is what happens, if this is what there is for those who violate Hashem's will, how much more so for those who do Hashem's will? So on the surface of it, and this is how the Mefarish explains, is Bar Kapara is talking about the contrast between Rebbe and himself. It sounds like he's calling Rebbe that you're over at Ritzonai, and look at this, you have so much wealth and opulence and everything, that you're spending such an enormous amount of money on the Simcha, and I, the Oseh Ritzonai, you're not inviting. The question, though, with that would be, I mean, how could Bar Kapara say such a chutzpahdik thing about Rebbe, call him over at Ritzonai? So there are many, many, many different explanations about it. Marsha explains that what it is he definitely meant it l'shvach, but what he meant is, sometimes you have, we know there are tzaddikim, who are zoicha l'beiz shulchonis, as the Gemara expresses it, that they're zoicha both to greatness in Torah and to greatness in wealth and power. Rebbe had that. The Gemara elsewhere says that on him, Torah gdula b'makam echad. So he's saying, im la'ovre ritzonei kach, if you find that there are wealthy and comfortable people in this world who are over the Ritzonai, who are violating what Hashem wants, how much more so that Rebbe and people like him, Oseh Ritzonai, deserve to have even more than that. But then they misunderstood him and thought that he was saying something negative against Rebbe, so then they ended up inviting him to the chasana, and then he clarified what he was saying in the first place. So according to Maharsha, he was never saying anything in the first place against Rebbe. Now, there are a lot of other different explanations about it. Iyun Yaakov refers over here to, the Iyun Yaakov was a famous Rav in his times. He wrote other important Sfarim, including Shailos HaTshuvos Shvus Yaakov. So he explains in one of his Shailos HaTshuvos over there, and everybody else after that refers to it, That what Bar Kappara is talking about is actually, it's a question like this. Now, again, the Gemara is going to go on to say over here that Rebbe was always very serious and sad over the Churban and over the troubles of the Jewish people. Whereas Bar Kappara took the view, you have to be Ivduas Hashem b'simcha. So now you find at the end of Makkos, you have the famous story involving Rabbi Akiva and his Chaverim, where they came to the site of the Bais HaMikdash. First, they came to Rome, they were coming to Rome, and they're hearing the tumult over there of how wealthy and successful they are. And then they went to the, then later on, they went to the site of the Har HaBayis and they saw it destroyed and foxes running around. And in both cases, they cried and Rabbi Akiva laughed. And they asked him why. And the first one, he explains to them with Rome that Imla Ovre Ritzon Ekach, the Romans who are violating what Hashem wants, and Hashem gives them so much wealth and power and everything. How much more so, how much more so is waiting for us Jews? So therefore, so the Iyun Yaakov explains that Bar Kappara was hinting at that story with his phrase over here. What he means is, in other words, he's by writing that on the wall, he's hinting at this point that if the Ovrei Ritzonoi are able to be so wealthy and powerful and everything, how much more so the Osei Ritzonoi, and therefore this is meant as a coded message to Rebbe. Don't think you always have to be so sad and serious in the time of Golos. No, you can instead be like Rabbi Akiva and be happy and realize that that Mashiach is yet going to come and there's going to be even greater greatness for us. So everybody brings that, although the Chidah has some problems with it. So the Chidah rather explains that what Bar Kappara is actually referring to is the guests by the wedding. He's saying that the guests by the wedding, given that Rebbe is being too serious and he's not inviting Bar Kappara the Badchan, so it comes out nobody is being Sameach Chosin Bakala. Well, then they're over Bachamisha Koilis. So therefore, in over Ritzone Kach, if they're over Ritzone and yet they have such a fancy wedding, La'osir Ritzone, Alachas Kama Bakama, how much more so it would be if they were Osir Ritzone and they were Sameach Chosin Bakala the way they're supposed to be. Then you have another explanation that the Chassam Sofer brings in the name of his brother-in-law. The Chassam Sofer was married twice. His second wife was the daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eger. So now Rabbi Akiva Eger's son, Rabunim, was the Chassam Sofer's brother-in-law. So he brings this following Pirush in his name. That it is referring to Rebbe, and Bar Kappara is calling Rebbe. How could he call Rebbe over at Sono? Because we find here and in other places, we learned in Ksubas, that Rebbe never had any Hana from this world. As much as he was rich and everything, and he had, as the Gemara tells us in Avodah Zarah, he always had the rarest vegetables on his table all the time. He personally never had any Hana from this world. He says right before he passed away, he lifted up his 10 fingers, and he said that then I never had any Hana from this world. So therefore, Bar Kappara is calling him out on that and saying that in a way over its owner, the Eibush to put you in the world that you should be able to enjoy the gashmius of it and use it for avodas Hashem. And then you have the Ksav Sofer, the Chassam Sofer's son, gives yet another explanation that he says that. What does he say? Let me think a second. I have to remember this one. All right. Meanwhile, there's also the Tiferes Tzion explains another point as well. There must have been Goyish guests by the party. Rebbe was the Nasi, but Pashtos, he has to stay on good terms with the Goyish rulers. So Bar Kappara is referring to them. If they're enjoying this wedding so much, La'osir Ritzono, the Jewish people who do Hashem's Ritzon, Alachas Kama V'Kama. We find, by the way, with Nehemiah, when he was the governor of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the second Bais HaMikdash, he also mentions having Goyim by his table, because what should you have? A Jewish ruler, a Jewish politician has to be able to do like that. He has to keep on good terms with the Goyim and invite them to his parties. So the Ksav Sofer says like this. He says, think about it. Rebbe is making this wedding, and he's obviously trying to do what everybody likes. Now, why didn't he invite me? Mistama, because he knows he doesn't want me to be my badchan self. So therefore, he didn't invite me in order that I shouldn't feel uncomfortable. So he's saying im la'oseret im la'ovretzone kach. So therefore, Mad, he's saying ovretzone about himself. Madach Rebbe is trying to look out for the best for me. The ovretzone he's calling himself that he doesn't want to invite me to a place where I know I'm not going to be comfortable because I can't be myself. La'oseretzone. Well, then the other wedding guests alachas kama v'kama that Rebbe must be doing everything for that he can for them. So then the bottom line is, according to these various explanations, according to some of them, he is in fact calling Rebbe over Ritzono for one reason or another, and according to other explanations, he's referring over Ritzono to others, the Goyish guests, or the Goyim in the world at large, or himself, etc. Whatever the case, they didn't understand him. Asmenei, so Rebbe invited him to the wedding. Osman, so Rebbe invited him to the wedding. Omar, so now Bar Kapara says the other way around. Madoch, those who do what Hashem wants in this world have such great wealth. How much more so those who do Hashem's will get so much more in Olam Haba. So again, according to the explanations that he, to begin with, said it as a derogatory thing about Rebbe. So now that Rebbe invited him, he changed it. And according to those who learned that to begin with, he was saying it in a coded way and they didn't fully understand him. So now he's clarifying himself that no, of course, Rebbe is in the category of Oser Tzone, and imagine how much more wealth is waiting for him in Olam Haba. The Medrash, by the way, when it tells the story, tells a little bit differently. We're saying that Rebbe forgot to invite Bar Kapara to the wedding. Afterwards, when Bar Kapara pointed that out to him, so it was bad. I guess it was too late to invite him or something. So therefore, so instead, Rebbe made the next party in honor of the wedding, one of the Sheva Brachas. Then he invited Bar Kapara. Okay. So the Gemara continues speaking about Rebbe and Bar Kapara. On a day when Rebbe would laugh, then puranus, then punishment would come to the world. Now again, there's a lot of different explanations why that should be. Why is Rebbe never allowed to be happy in his lifetime? So Maharsha gives the reason because Rebbe was a Baal Yisurim. We know for this Gemara in Bava Metzia that tells us that Rebbe was suffering Yisurim for many years, and that it was a kapara, it helped the whole world. They didn't even need rain during that time. The Gemara points out, as much as rain is a bracha, it sometimes also can be an inconvenience. So in Rebbe's times, there was so much moisture in the air, the plants were able to grow beautifully without actually needing the inconvenience of rain. So therefore, if during that time Rebbe is going to laugh, then it means that the world is not going to gain that benefit. So therefore, instead, some kind of disaster is coming to the world. Now, on the other hand, what was Bar Kapara's view of the matter? Bar Kapara took the view that again, a yid has to be besimcha. As we find, in fact, that if he's besimcha, then he'll be able to come to Olam Haba more easily. There's a Gemara in Tainus, for example, that tells about two people who were they would make it their business to always be mesameach people who are in a bad mood or a quarrel or whatever, and with that they were zeicha to Olam Haba. So Bar Kapara figured that Rebbe should be the same way as well. Iyun Yaakov gives another point as well. We have in Pirkei Avos, that laughter is one of those things that make a person prone to arayas. Rebbe being Rabbeinu HaKodesh, where again, he went to the nth degree, to the ultimate degree, as far as staying away from any possibility of erva, and therefore he's called Rabbeinu HaKodesh, so for him, laughter wouldn't be appropriate. Then you have Rabbeinu Bachaye gives an explanation that, again, Bar Kapara figured that a yid has to be besimcha, and he figured with simcha, then Rebbe will be able to learn and teach Torah better. Rebbe, meanwhile, took the view, a person always has to be, similar to what the Rambam says, always has to be b'kava mitzua, always on the middle ground, neither too much in one direction or the other. And so Rebbe figured that if Rebbe didn't want to laugh, because then that would be too far over to one extreme, and then that would upset the equilibrium, the medium point that he's supposed to be at. And then there's many different other explanations about what the nub of the argument was between Rebbe and Bar Kapara about whether Rebbe should laugh or not. Anyway, so Omale the Bar Kapara loy tevadchon. So he tells Bar Kapara, I don't want you to try to make me laugh. He knew, again, Bar Kapara is a jovial kind of person. He's going to make him laugh. So he tells him, don't. And if you do that, if you keep to your word, then I'll give you 40 grivi of wheat. A griva is usually translated as a saw, so it would be quite a large amount. It would be quite a large amount of wheat. Why Dafka 40? Iyun Yaakov points out it represents the 40 days when the Torah was given. Also, he mentions there's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah that tells that Antoninus used to send Rebbe every day a sack full of wheat. So therefore, Rebbe had plenty of wheat available, and therefore he's offering some of it to Bar Kapara if he keeps this promise. But Bar Kapara answers, Lech Zimar, Rebbe, take a look and you'll see, de kol grivan de be'ina shekilna. I'll be able to take as many saw as I want. I'm not limited dafka to your 40 saw. Shokol de kula rabba. So Bar Kapara took a large basket. Tachye bekufra. He smeared it with tar, so it would be waterproof and fill in all the holes and all that, so nothing falls out. And he turned it upside down. There's two different ways of understanding sach ve'areshe. It can mean that he turned it upside down, or it can mean that the Ran learns it means he just turned it upside down. Maharsha learns that it means he put it on his own head. He put it upside down over his own head, like the way Maharsha compares to like the way we wear Purim costumes. Anyway, He comes at V'ozol, and he comes to Rebbe V'omalei, and he says Leichol limara boin grivichiti derashinen bach. Rebbe, measure out for me, please, the 40 saw of wheat that you owe me. Now what? He's going to do it in an upside down basket or a basket that's on his head. And besides, the whole point was he's not supposed to make Rebbe laugh. Achich Rebbe laughed. And then he says, "Lava azartich, lava azhartacha, delay tivadchan." Didn't I already warn you not to make me laugh for any of the reasons that we said before? By the way, the Shittim of Kubetzes makes another point about it as well. Why it was so bad if Rebbe would laugh? Rebbe was always feeling serious and somewhat sad about the Churban. So therefore, so in other words, so for him to be laughing at a time like this is similar to the Shavuos Yaakov's explanation before about the argument between Bar Kappara and Rebbe, where Bar Kappara is saying you can be more in that regard like Rabbi Akiva, but Rebbe held the view that he needs to be constantly sad over the Churban and not feel so happy when we're in Golos as long as there's a Churban. We find, by the way, interestingly, in that connection, we find a medrash in Eicha Rabbah where it says there was a certain pasuk in Eicha where Rebbe would darshan 24 drushas on a certain pasuk, and then Rabbi Yochanan, a generation later, would darshan 60 drushas. So the medrash asks, what does that mean? Did Rabbi Yochanan know more on this pasuk than Rebbe? And the answer is no. Rebbe knew all the drushas that Rabbi Yochanan did, but once he would get through 24 of them, he would be so overcome with tears that he couldn't continue. Because he lived a generation closer to the Churban than Rabbi Yochanan, so he really felt it personally in a way that Rabbi Yochanan, who lives in a later generation, didn't. And so that fits very well with this, with what the Shittim of Kubetzes is saying over here, that therefore Rebbe felt that it's inappropriate for him to laugh.
That's on Shabbos and Yom Tov.
On Shabbos and Yom Tov, did he laugh? I mean, hopefully he wasn't sad over the Churban, but still there's a difference between not being sad and laughing. Mind you, I mean the Minchas Elazar actually says a vort on this that Bar Kappara took the view. Fine, it's one thing for Rebbe to be sad, but we don't want him to be motor dick. We don't want him to be depressed, and therefore he's trying to cheer him up. But anyway, so Rebbe laughed as a result of what Bar Kappara did over here with the upside down basket. Omalei says lavas how to hold a delay to vadchan. Didn't I warn you not to make me laugh? Omalei and Bar Kappara kind of still playing along with the joke. He says, "Chiti derashin and kanasivna. I'm only coming to collect the wheat that you owe me." Meaning, in other words, Maharsha says it flows like he's making almost another joke of it. Like here, Rebbe is telling him, "Listen, you didn't keep to your side of the deal. Therefore, I don't owe you the 40 saw of wheat." So Bar Kappara pretends as though, "Never mind that, but there's a different debt of wheat that you owe me from previously, and I'm here to collect that." So like he's still trying to continue the joke, kind of. Getting back to the wedding that we said before, or maybe it was a different wedding, Omalei Bar Kappara, yeah, it was the same wedding, as the Gemara goes on to say, the wedding of Reb Shimon Berebi that we said before. So Omalei Bar Kappara Lebrate de Rebbe. So before the wedding, Bar Kappara says to, or before the Sheva Barachas that we were talking about, whichever the one that Bar Kappara ended up being invited to, he tells Rebbe's daughter, Lemocher Shasina Chamra, tomorrow I will be drinking wine at this wedding, Berikuda de Avuch, accompanied by the dancing of your father over kurkani de imach and with the kurkani of your mother. Now, what is kurkani? The Ran explains that it means singing. He explains that kurkani is Maloshan makarka, which means like crowing, like the noise that a chicken makes or something, like the crowing of a rooster. So he's saying so it refers to her singing or like croaking or so or some sound like that. The Mefarish translates it as that she's going to pour me wine. In the event, as the Gemara goes on to tell the story, she didn't. She neither sang nor poured him wine. But a lot of the Mefarishim deal with the question: how is he even saying that such a thing hypothetically would happen anyway? What happened to Kol B'Isha Erva? What happened to you not allowed to have a woman serve you? So a number of Achronim give different possibilities how it couldn't be made to work lahalacha. Maybe doing the simcha of a wedding is a special exception. Maybe Bar Kappara was on a high enough level as a tzaddik that there's no problem of hirhurim for him. A number of different answers that they give, but Ben Yehoyada gives a couple of interesting points. First of all, he says that ultimately it refers to Bar Kappara as referring to deep things in Kabbalah, and he talks about how the father and the mother over here, Rebbe and his wife, represent respectively Yaakov and Leah, Yaakov and Rachel, and it refers to high things in Olam HaSoyonim that they represent. But anyway, he says that also kurkani de imach could mean not so much singing, but rather the kind of high-pitched noise that they do even now in some Sfardish communities. You have by simchas, la 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 la, so that they do. So that's not singing. That wouldn't be an issue of kol b'isha. Actually, Ben Yehoyada points out an interesting thing in this connection. He says, the Medrash says that when Yaakov was supposed to be marrying Rachel, and meanwhile Lavan brought him Leah instead. So the Medrash says the people of the town were also in on the scam together with Lavan. They knew that he's substituting Leah for Rachel. They were singing a song that the refrain of it was something like "He Leah, He Leah, He Leah." So that way, when the next morning, when Yaakov discovers what happened, and he goes to Lavan and complains, "Lomo rimi sonny, why'd you cheat me?" And then the Medrash says he also went to the townspeople and said, "Well, why did you cheat me?" And they said, "We didn't. We were trying to warn you. He Leah. She is Leah." So Ben Yehoyada says maybe based on this, maybe it was the same kind of thing. They're doing this, da, 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 da. So they're doing it in a way that makes it to make it sound like he Leah, so that way they could claim later on that they were trying to warn him without actually warning him. Anyway, so he says that's what it means, kukene de imach over here. So in that case, there'd be no issue of kol isha. Okay. So what actually happened by the wedding or by the sheva brachos? The Gemara continues. Benalosa chasne de Rebbe hava. Benalosa, and that was we don't know his first name, but the Gemara is only identifying him by his father's name, as we'll talk about. We'll learn soon, Bezus Hashem, why that is. Anyway, chasne de Rebbe hava. He was Rebbe's son-in-law. Va'osher gadol hoya, and he was very rich. Umoto Asmanil Behilula Reb Shimon Berebi. So now Bakapora came to this wedding or this Sheva Brachas of Reb Shimon Berebi. And in the course of the wedding or the Simcha, Omale Bakapora Lerebi, my Toeva. We find in the Torah, when it talks about Mishkav Zohar, it calls it Te'eva. Now, there's a couple of dozen arayas that it talks about over there, but no other one is called Te'eva. And vice versa, there are a number of other isurim in the Torah that are called Te'eva, but only by Mishkav Zohar do you have both, where it's one of the arayas, and uniquely among them, it's called Te'eva. And in fact, twice, once in Achrimos, when it warns you not to do it, and once in Parshas Kedoshim, when it talks about the punishment for it. So why? What's this word Te'eva mean? Called the Omalei Rebbe, the Hochi Hu Te'eva, Akshay Bakapara. So Rebbe started explaining different explanations of what Te'eva means and why Mishkav Zohar is called that, and every one of them Bakapara slugged up. Omalei Rebbe Polish Ak. So eventually Rebbe gives up and he says to Bakapara, fine, you tell me what's the meaning of Te'eva in this context. Omalei. So he tells him, Tesi Devesu, Turmali Nakla, let Rebbe's wife come and pour me a cup of wine. Asir Amulei, sure enough, she poured for him. So that bears out when he said before, B'krukeni de'imach, and the Mefarish says, it means you're going to see that your mother, the Rebbetzin, the wife of the Nasi, is going to pour me a cup of wine. So now that taka came true. Omalei the Rebbe, kum rekoidli v'omalach, and he says to Rebbe, come dance for me, and then I'll tell you. And Rebbe went ahead with it because Rebbe wanted, obviously we see from the story, Rebbe wanted so much to know a new concept in Torah that he didn't know before that he's willing even to set aside his kavod, the kavod of the Nasi of the Jewish people and the kavod of his Rebbetzin, just in order to be able to learn something new in Torah. Omalei. So now when Rebbe does that, he says, Hochi Omer Achmana, Te'eva means Toya Ata Bo. You are going astray with it. In other words, it's one thing, arayas between a man and a woman, fine. A man has a taiva for a woman. But to go after a man, which is something completely unnatural, so toya ataba, you're going astray with it. It's something completely unnatural. Well, yeah, ba meaning in it, in the arayas, in the erva of a zocher. Erva is lashon nekeva. Then they came, it was time to drink another cup during the Simcha. So Bakapara says to Rebbe, my tevel, what does it mean when it could, also in the parasha of Arayas, you have for a man to have relations with an animal, the Pasuk says on it, tevel, who actually about a woman, by a woman who has relations with an animal, so it calls it tevel who. So what's this word tevel? So again, it happened like before that Rebbe is trying to find answers, and every one of them Bakapara is shlugging up. Do for me what I tell you. Ovid, true enough, he does. That is, his Rebbetzin pours him a cup and he dances for him. And then he explains, Tevel, who means Tavlin Yeshba. Is there a spice in it? Like, what makes it, what would make a person think that there's any, that there, why would a person even have a taiva for such a thing? Is there any taiva? At least with Mishkav Zohar, at least you could say, it's a human being. But here, it's an animal as well. So it's an animal. It's not even the same species as a person. So why would a person even have a taiva for such a thing? It's something completely unnatural. Maharsha points out, now we have the word tevel that mentions in the parasha of Arayis also with a man and his daughter-in-law. The difference is, there you can say, Rashi mentions that they're tevel who means that there's a bilbul. You're mixing up zera'av and zera'aben. You're mixing up the descent, the two different generations. But with a person and an animal, where it's impossible for any children to be produced from it, then it can't mean that. So therefore he explains that it means like that. The question, mishanya hodabia mikolon bias, is such a bia different than any other? How is such a bia different than all the other ones? How is it that she abandons somebody, a fellow human being like her, and goes after a behemoth? So therefore, the pasuk calls it in a derogatory word tevel. Umay zima. Then Vakapara does a third one. What is it in connection with another thing of Arayas, where a man. So in connection with a couple of the Arayas, it uses the word zima. But Maharsha explains specifically the reference to Zima over here is actually where the Torah tells us in Parshas Kedoshim, "Al techalalas bitcha lahaznoisa." Don't allow your daughter to become to be loosely available to everybody, because then the earth will be full of Zima. The Gemara explains we're talking about Pnuya, so there's no issue of Eishes Ish or Arayas or anything like that. However, there is an issue that then she's going to have children from different fathers, and the children aren't going to know who their fathers are, and the result is that siblings may end up marrying one another, and there's going to be problems of Mamzerus and all of that. So why does the Torah use the word Zima in that connection? And the same thing, when man goes and marries women, and the Gemara mentions that by the same token, a man goes and marries women in different places, you have the other problem that then, again, they may end up meeting up and marrying, etc. The same thing happened, that Bakapara is challenging Rebbe to do whatever he wants before he gives him the answer. Finally, Bakapara gives him the answer. Omale Zumahi. This, what is it? Meaning, in other words, that's the point. The whole reason for it is that what is this? Whose children are these? And you can come to Sophic Mamzeus. The Maharal has an explanation why Bakapara did Davka these three droshes, all of which have to do with things of Arayas, and he explains, because basically we're talking about a wedding over here, as we said before. It was a very expensive wedding, and there was a huge amount of enjoyment begashmias. So Bakapara wants to tell everybody in his own badchonistika way. It's not stam badchonis. He wants to teach them a lesson in that that you should realize that gashmias is not really worth very much in itself. That whether we're talking about toya ataba or tevel, tavlin yeshba, or Zumahi, you should realize what are all these things worth. They're not really worth anything as just the Gashmias by itself. Gashmias is only worthwhile as if it serves Ruchnius. Well, the Gemara says, Lo yochol ben Alossa lemispel. Ben Alossa, the son-in-law of Rebbe, couldn't stand it that Rebbe was being so humiliated like that. And Ben Alossa himself was rich. He was also, Ion Yaakov points out, he was from a Meyuchistika family. He understands that he's called Ben Alossa because he's descended from the family of Rabbi Shmuel Ben Elisha, the Kohen Gadol. So he himself is rich. He himself is a Meyuchis. So he couldn't stand seeing his shver being insulted like that. Kom v'nofak huva insei mitamon. So he and his wife got up and left the simcha. The Medrash in Kehelis, by the way, when it tells the story about Rebbe, about Bakapara, about the Simcha, it mentions another thing that happened over there, is that Bakapara was entertaining the people with Mesholim so much so that they weren't interested in the food. So Rebbe, after all, wonders, how come it is? Food's being brought out of the kitchen, and the plates are coming back to the kitchen untouched. So what happened? And he finds out because Bakapara is busy entertaining everybody with Mesholim to illustrate various points in Torah. So the Gemara says, "My Ben Alossa." What about Ben Alossa? So the Mefardish explains that it means, "How do we know that he was rich?" But Maharsha says, "No, that's not what it means. We know he was rich because the Braisa just told us before that he was rich. No, the question is, why is he being called Ben Alossa? Why is he called by his personal name?" So the answer is going to come out from the following story. So, D'Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Loy l'chinam pisa ben al-osa es ma'osev. It's not for nothing that ben al-osa spent a lot of his money, elo l'haris behen tispodus shal kohen gadol. He wanted to learn and to have his own hair cut in the style of the kohen gadol. As Iyun Yaakov had learned, that he himself is actually a descendant of the kohen gadol, Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, so therefore he had a particular interest in it.
Every day?
I don't know, the kohen gadol didn't cut his hair every day, he cut it every week. So does this mean he did it as a one-time thing? Does it mean he constantly did it? Doesn't say. But in any case, he spent an enormous amount of money because it's a very complicated haircut. The pasuk says that the kohenim should cut their hair, which means, Mefarshim explain, it comes from the word kusemes, spelt, because spelt stalks grow in the way that the Gemara is going to describe over here. Now, Yechezkel is actually talking about it, about the kohenim in general. So there's a number of details that Yechezkel mentions in his last prakim that seem to be different than the way the Torah says things. Some of the Mefarshim, the Gemara in a couple of places explains that maybe in fact it is referring only to the Kohen Gadol, but a number of the Mefarshim explain there that it means that La'asid Lava in the third Beis Hamikdash, the regular Kohenim will have the same degree of kedusha as the Kohen Gadol in earlier times, and therefore they'll all have to take this special haircut. In any case, what is this kind of haircut? Tana, we learn in a braisa, ke'en luluyonis. It's a luluyonis style of haircut. My luluyonis, well, what does that mean? Rabbi Yehuda, tispota yechidza. It means a unique kind of haircut. There's no other haircut like it. Now, what is this? So back up. So Maharsha explains that the question according to Maharsha was, why are we calling him Ben Alossa rather than calling him by his personal name? The reason is like this. We figure like this. Often it happens, we see Maisim B'chol Yoim, people who earn their own money tend to be very careful with it, as opposed to people who inherited a fortune from their ancestors. Not always do they realize the value of money, and sometimes they end up squandering it. So here we're saying Ben Alossa did spend a huge amount of his money, but it wasn't on wasteful things like many other heirs of rich people do. Rather, he did it for a good purpose in order to learn and in order to preserve the style of haircut of the Kohen Gadol for future generations, and maybe to get that haircut himself. Anyway, Heichidomi, what exactly is the nature of this haircut? It means that the tip of one hair exactly touches the root of the next hair of the next hair next to it. A couple of Mefoshim discuss what the symbolism behind it is. Habona at the bottom of the page over here explains that the Kohen Gadol is supposed to constantly be focused on the Shechina, and therefore that represents also that, in other words, like the one hair goes directly into the next one, representing that his mind is constantly focused on. Of course, there's an explanation that it means that he should be humble, like you should always remember his roots. Whatever the case, it's a special kind of haircut. This is the haircut of the Kohen Gadol, so it's a very difficult thing to do, and therefore Ben Alossa had to spend an enormous amount of money in order to learn it, in order to get such a haircut himself. Further on, the Gemara talks about, again, talking about these various cases where a person makes a neder not to eat various kinds of food. So the Mishnah mentions there can be a case where he says dog or dogim, and the Gemara also talks about what if he says dogga. So is there a difference in meaning between dog and dogga? So first, the Gemara tries to say that they mean different sizes of fish. Maybe a dog means a large fish, and dog go would mean a small fish. So the Gemara says, "Ksiv." Though we have the pasuk by about Yonah, "Vayeman Hashem dog gadol livloyas Yonah." First, the pasuk says that Hashem appointed a big fish to swallow Yonah. So we see that dog means dafka, a big fish. But the Gemara asks, "Voxi vayispalo Yonah v'gamim mead dog ga." But the next pasuk says that Yonah davened to Hashem from the belly of the dog ga. So what is it, a dog or a dog ga? So the Gemara says, "Holy kasha, that's not a problem. Dumei palte dog ga de labale dog cotton chola. Maybe the big fish spat him out, and then a small fish swallowed him, and he ended up in the belly of a small fish." The Gemara goes on with the discussion of what dog versus dog ga means. But in any case, Maharsha points out that in fact the Medrash says exactly that. What happened was, when Yonah was thrown into the sea by the sailors over there, then he got in, he was swallowed up by the big fish. He was very comfortable in there. The fish's eyes, the Medrash goes into great detail, the fish's eyes were like two windows. He's looking out through them, he's seeing everything that's going on under sea. He's having he's been given a nice tour of the site under the Beis Mikdash and the gates of Gan Eden and so forth, and he's having a good time of it. So he didn't think to daven. So what does the Eibush to do? He makes it that that fish spits him out, and he ends up in the belly of a smaller fish, a female. That one is carrying a bunch of eggs. So now it's very crowded in there. Now when it's crowded and it's less comfortable, then he thought to daven. Maharsha points out, though, it seems a little hard in that case to understand, because at the end, the pasuk says, "Vayomer Hashem la'dog," Hashem said to the dog, which according to this would mean the big fish again. So what does that mean? The small fish threw him out again, and then the big fish swallowed him, and that one let him out onto dry land. Doesn't say one way or the other. But in any case, the Medrash does make that point, that there were actually two different fish involved over here. Speaking of fish, actually, now you have a very rare thing. You have the Ein Yaakov was published a few decades before the Maharsha was born. So his Pirushim over here of Chiddush HaGadus are structured according to Ein Yaakov. But here he has the following piece over here that doesn't appear in Ein Yaakov. It's part of the regular Gemara itself, and nevertheless Maharsha comments on it. There's a piece of Gemara further on, talking about more about fish on the subject of when is it good to eat fish and when not. The Gemara discusses sometimes when a person is sick, then fish is bad for him, other times it's good. So the Gemara brings in this connection that Shmuel says a way to remember it. You think of the letters Nun, Samach, and Ayin in order in the Aleph Beis. Nun in Aramaic also means a fish. Samach is related to the word Sama, which means a cure. And ayin is like the word ayin, the eye. So Shmuel says from that, you learn from the, you have a hint for that. Nuna samala inayin. Fish is a remedy for the eye. And the Gemara explains it means if a person had an eye infection, then at a certain stage of it, then fish is good for him. So Maharsha brings in this connection, an interesting point. We find when the Jewish people were complaining about the man in the Midbar the second time in Parshas Baaloska, the first time actually in Parshas Baaloska, they complain that we remember the fish we used to eat in Mitzrayim, and now all we have is the Mon. So Maharsha says this fits very nicely with this Gemara. They were saying bilti ala mon einenu. They were saying now we only have mon for our eyes. We don't have fish, which according to this Gemara, according to what Shmuel is saying in this Gemara, is good for your eyes. Now we don't have that. Only we have mon for our eyes, and it's not going to be so curative for our eyes as fish would be. Yeah. Okay. Even though they could taste every taste, I guess they figured that it still doesn't have the same effect. Yeah. Okay. So you have the concept of Malava Malka, and you have Al Derech HaDrush. So you have like this. The Beis Yosef famously says that there's a certain aver in a person which only benefits from the food they eat Matzah Shabbos. So the Etzem Luz. So it doesn't gain from the Sodas of Shabbos, only the Soda of Matzah Shabbos. Now, why is that? So the El Yerabba there on Shulchan Aruch on the tour explains that the Etzem Luz did not get anything when Adam and Chava ate from the Eitz Hadas. So they're precisely because of that, because it only gets from the food you eat Matzah Shabbos, and they ate from the Eitz Hadas and Erev Shabbos. That's why the Luz bone never disappears, because the whole concept of death came from the Chet Eitz Hadas. So therefore the Etzem Luz did not benefit from the Eitz Hadas, then therefore that's higher than the whole concept of death, and that's why the body will be rebuilt from it by Tchias Mesim. And so that is the deeper idea behind the Malava Malka, is to fix up the Chet Eitz Hadas. Continuing on halachos of Eruv Chatzeres, suppose you have two courtyards or that are one further back than the other. So the only way to get from the inner one out to the street is by going through the outer one. Sometimes you have nowadays, sometimes you have some apartment buildings also arranged that way. So if they want, they can make one Eruv together. If they don't make an Eruv together, then the people in the inner one can make their own Eruv. And they'll be allowed to carry in their chotzer, but the people in the outer one will not. The outer ones didn't make an eruv at all, whether they made an eruv and it didn't work. If the ones from the inner one did not make an eruv or their eruv was ineffective, then the outer one's eruv is not going to work either, because the inner ones, the bnei apnimis, they're constantly walking through the outer one. It's called drisas haregel, and the result is that they aser the outer one. The basic idea with an eruv chatzeres is any time that you have two or more people that have reshus in one area, then you need an eruv chatzeres. Here, the idea is the people from the inner one are walking through the outer one. They have a certain reshus over there, and therefore, if they didn't make an eruv of their own, the Gemara calls it regel ha'osur b'm Koima, where they're not allowed to carry in their own area, in their own inner chotzer, then they also aser. The result is they aser the outer chotzer as well. So then on the other hand, if you have the inner one, there's only one yid, so then one person by himself doesn't need an eruv, so then he's not aser in the outer one. The bottom line is you have certain complications over here. The bottom line is make sure to make an eruv chatzeres before Shabbos, and check with a rav to make sure that you do it right, because otherwise you may have issues with carrying in and out of your houses on Shabbos if you need to do so.